Hello and welcome to Medic in the Middle. Medic in the Middle is a podcast hosted by myself, registered paramedic Tom Alderson. The podcast explores a range of different topics, issues and articles and features a range of guests from both in-hospital and pre-hospital specialties. In this episode, we are extremely lucky to be joined by West Midlands Care Team, who work as a charity organisation to provide enhanced clinical care to seriously injured and unwell patients across the West Midlands. So, hello, yeah, welcome to Medic in the Middle. We're really lucky today to be joined by West Midlands Care Team. So we've got Pete, Amir and Steph joining us. I'll let them kind of introduce themselves and as to what it is that they do day to day. Which way should we go around? We'll start with Pete.
I'm Peter, a volunteer with the West Midlands Care Team. I'm one of the clinical supports within the team. I've been there a few years now, and I also help coordinate some of the other logistics within the team.
Nice one. Amir?
Yes, my name's Amir. I'm one of the clinical leads for the care team. Been with the team now for 5 years. I'm also a trauma surgeon at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham.
And Steph?
Yeah, so I'm Steph. I am also lucky enough to be one of the clinical leads for the care team. I'm an A&E doctor by background, and I fly for the Midlands Air Ambulance Service and also fly for the Air Ambulance Service in Coventry, Warwickshire.
Cool. And I'm Tom. As many of you know, I'm a paramedic working within the West Midlands and a practice educator. Who wants to be the plugger? We're all looking at you.
You've got that advertising voice. Come on, and then you can plug your third
Thursday. Care team session. Yeah. Sorry. What's the care team?
So the care team was set up about just over 30 years ago now. A central accident resuscitation emergency team, and that was basically it started off as flying doctor squad, if you will, in the very late 80s, early 90s, and they came to their prominence during the ambulance strikes at that time. Responding pre-hospitally from the orthopaedic hospital in Birmingham, and it's a multidisciplinary team approach, and what that means is you can typically find a nurse, paramedic and doctor combination or variation of that, and nowadays ACPs and the likes as well. We're a volunteer charitable service based in Birmingham. We respond around Birmingham and the nearby areas as required as well. We respond for the ambulance service to critically unwell patients as part of the enhanced care team dispatch criteria for the West Midlands Ambulance Service. You can search us on Google, West Midlands Care Team, and you can also follow our work on social media at WM Care Team as well. So we run a publicly facing lecture on the third Thursday of each month. It's usually on the third Thursday, and that's called Care Team Sessions.
Is that normally the one at the orthopaedic hospital in Birmingham?
That's it. Yep. It's right back where it all began. So it's there, and it is in. It's there every third Thursday, and very rarely on a different day. But if you follow us at WM Care Team on social media, you'll be able to keep up with that. You can also check the previous sessions. If you missed them, we podcast them. We edit down what the speakers when we've recorded the speakers. We edit it down, form a podcast. So if you search all major podcast providers like Spotify and Apple Podcasts and things like that, you'll find the care team sessions, and hopefully you'll find something useful there. You can get a CPD certificate as well for donating to the team.
Brilliant, cool. So yeah, go and check them out, and make sure you give them a follow on Twitter. Keep up with all their latest, including their podcast too. Today we're going to be talking about RTCs and pelvic injuries associated with RTCs. So we'll just quickly start off with some data from last year. Just on RTCs briefly. So last year in 2021, there was an estimated 1,558 reported deaths. So of these figures, there's been 128,209 casualties of all severities across 2021. So it is something we need to be aware of and know how to manage and appropriately deal with, as they are more frequent than we may think. So management then, when we get to these RTCs,
We just need to have a good overall scene awareness and some initial scene management strategies. Pete, you might be a good one to kind of start us off on this, being as your background's with the hazardous area response team as well. Do you want to kind of just talk us through some of the things we need to be considering during the initial arrival at an RTC?
Yeah, I think there's lots of elements that will set you up for a good smooth running of an incident, certainly logistically speaking. I think some of the frameworks are out there for you to look into. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the frameworks that's fairly standard nationally would be CSCAT, mm-hmm. or CSCAT, as some might call it. And that comprises of C for command and control, S for safety, C for communication, A for assessment, and then you've got triage, treat, and transport are your T's at the end. So when we're talking about command and control, it doesn't necessarily mean, do we have officers on the way, you know, designated substantive officers on the way to the job? Mm-hmm. Because if you show up as the first clinician on scene, you will act as the incident commander for the ambulance service if the scene requires kind of command and control from that perspective. But then that also means if you do think you need a substantive officer to take that burden and workload off you, you should be requesting them early. When we're talking then about safety, you should be dynamically risk assessing the scene as you approach, and I think a good fend off of your vehicle to protect the scene if you're the first vehicle on scene. And sometimes you might have a fire appliance might be first on scene, and usually they'll fend off from the side where there's approaching traffic. If that's the case and you're the second responding vehicle, you'll move past the incident if you can and fend off on the opposite side as well, just to seal off that scene and give yourself a safe working environment. So I think that's where we're coming from a safety perspective.
Yeah,
and
absolutely,
also
yeah.
The PPE that you think is required. So you may be working in the car, so you might need to wear your helmet, but as a minimum you should have your high-vis jacket on, because there'll be lots of distractions at incidents like these and lots of people rubbernecking driving past as well. So yeah. So that's a risk. So
not only that, it's good when you've got like different services that start arriving. If you're wearing a high-vis, it's very obvious that you are there in a kind of more official capacity, rather than it can be quite hard to see if it's dark, for example, and you've got your normal ambulance screens on. Do you know what I mean? It's quite,
yeah, absolutely.
We and can then see who each other are.
That's a good point, because CSCAT isn't linear. So once we're on scene, we can come back to C to command and control. You're easily identifiable, and somebody from one of the other services might come towards you and give you information. And that's Jessup starting. So Jessup starts from a control room perspective before you arrive, but it also starts on scene with your initial arrival, if we're taking it that you're first on scene. So somebody from another service will come and start that conversation with you, or you'll go and try and find them. And I know that might be hard, because we're clinicians on a day-to-day basis. We're not used to that, but for the betterment of the patients that are on scene and the smooth logistical running of the scene, it might be beneficial just to step aside for a couple of minutes, share situational awareness with the other services, recognise what the priorities are and how you can work together to expedite that process.
Yeah. Just for those who aren't aware, Jessup is what we have in the UK. It's called the Joint Emergency Services Interoperability Programme. And it's just something that helps different disciplines, police, fire, ambulance, and different kind of branches of the ambulance service work together and understand the scenes and the protocols involved with managing scenes a little bit better. Moving on to RTCs then, and I just want to talk a little bit about entrapment versus non-entrapment. So there was a paper done by Tim Nutbeen and Rob Fenwick in 2021, so last year, and they did a retrospective TARN database analysis, and they kind of found from that, in summary, that trapped patients have a higher mortality, they have a higher injury severity score in the trapped group versus the non-trapped group. They kind of did a review from patients over 2012 to 2018, and they reviewed 63,000 patients. 6,983 of these were trapped, and 56,642 of them were non-trapped. So it's only 11% trapped, but they worked out that over the trapped group versus the non-trapped group, that the injury severity scores were higher, they had higher chances of mortality and serious injury patterns. So they did a comparison of demographics. This paper was posted in the Scandinavian Journal of Trauma, Resuscitation and Emergency Medicine in 2021. And it was titled Comparison of Demographics, Injury Patterns and Outcome Data for Patients Injured in Motor Vehicle Collisions Who Are Trapped Compared to Those Who Are Not Trapped. So they identified and found that spinal cord injuries were rare, So 0.71% of all of extrications, but frequently 50.1% had associated severe injuries. Spinal cord injuries were common in patients who were trapped, or more common so in those who were trapped. Trapped patients had more deranged physiology, sort of lower blood pressures, lower oxygen saturations, and their basic kind of baseline obviously being a little bit more out of parameter. Trapped patients, as mentioned, had more significant injuries of head, chest, abdomen and pelvic, and spine, and all an increased rate of pelvic injuries, rather, with more significant blood loss and blood loss from other areas or potential pneumothorax. Just want to kind of touch on what we mean by entrapment as well. So there are two types of entrapment. You've got absolute entrapment, which may mean that the patient's sort of physically trapped by wreckage or other materials. And then there's relative entrapment or medical entrapment, which may mean that they are trapped because of an injury or pain precluding movement, which is kind of more of a significant factor for ourselves working with these patients pre-hospitally. Do you guys know much about that study they did with the extrication? And just wanted to touch on it briefly about extricating patients who have not got any neurology and things like that, where they did that paper and things like the Exit Project. Yeah. Did you want to talk about that briefly? Just kind of summarise key points from that in case we've got people that are a little bit, if the patient's not entrapped and they haven't got any neurology, and it might just help people with their decision making.
They've just sat in the car.
Sat in the car. They haven't got any neurology. There's no major mechanism.
Do you want to talk more about the paper itself about entrapment?
Just more about conclusively what they found when they did that study on the biomechanics of people getting out and it being, less movement for the C-spine if they're self-extricating.
This paper, it's quite an important one because of what they're talking about there in terms of the injury severity. It's mechanistic in the sense that the severity of the RTC has caused that entrapment, and therefore it's reading that scene as you get to that to understand the physical entrapment that patient has.
Yeah.
And then therefore reading the severity of their injury pattern on the basis of that and recognising this person having been trapped is more likely to have some more severe injuries, and therefore you triage them even at that initial phase.
Just that initial visual.
Yeah, because that's very, that is an important factor in actually gauging whether they're trapped because there's something wedged against their legs or that they're just in pain because they've got a hurty neck.
Mm-hmm.
That's an initial triage, because them being pinned in the car is something that you need to escalate, isn't it?
You're going to have more severe.
That they might need a higher level of care, that they might be there for a longer period of time. And so you need to be able to actually manage that situation from the outset in a different manner than somebody who, they've got some neck pain.
Mm-hmm.
That they probably could, if we look back at that paper about the biomechanics,
we
can kind of bring in. But, so they've analysed the movement patterns of those patients and used volunteers, looked at how those methods, the kind of the different techniques, grabbing, snatching them out, taking out a B post or taking the roof off.
Mm-hmm. Versus getting them out, just come out voluntarily with
asking them to
manual.
Under their own effort, being able to take themselves out, and then how that compared from the spinal movement patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's relatively understandable that if you're in control of your own neck and you can get yourself out in a comfortable manner, that you'll be more protective of that. The interpretation of that and then how one applies that clinically is relevant, because can this person get themselves out or not is a crucial factor. The difficulty then comes if they can't get themselves out, and again, asking them whether they've got the ability.
Is it a physical entrapment or like you said, a medical one?
And then, yes, is it that they can't get themselves out because they're wedged in, and we need to recognise that they've got really severe injuries. You don't really want somebody getting themselves out necessarily if they've got major injuries. But then actually if they're relatively entrapped, as in they've got pain, And so it might just be a bit of coaxing, a bit of analgesia that might help them self-extricate. But then if we then take it on a step and look at what the rest of those findings were, when they compared then the other methods, snatching them out, taking off bits of the car, or taking the entire roof off, actually the movement patterns, when we take control of them, their movement pattern is higher than if they self-extricate.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, the movement pattern is equal between those techniques. So, and I appreciate in the sort of lab setting, they probably haven't ragged people.
Yeah, they haven't got the fire service taking the roof off, and the human factors that go along with it as well, like the adrenaline. And
they did that in the paper. They have taken the roof off, and they have analysed those factors yet.
But the time pressures and the physical, like the human factors, probably would have been a little bit more difficult, I guess, to gauge, wouldn't there? Because if you genuinely got like a really poorly patient that needs getting out, and they need getting out now, then so, might be like more movement involved with that.
What then analyses when you look at this spinal pattern being the same between the three techniques?
Mm.
Actually, just grabbing somebody out if they're really sick, or actually if they're not actually that sick and they've just got neck pain.
Yeah, and they're not entrapped.
Actually, isn't that different from just grabbing them out? But I think that's all factored into the fact that even when we snatch them out, there's still a level of protection that we're providing to them. And so as long as that there is, you know, a degree of mills, a degree of coordination about the extrication.
Mm-hmm. Proportionate to the situation.
Yeah.
Actually, it doesn't necessarily dictate that every car has to have its roof taken off.
No.
And if you need that person out, you can take them out safely in any manner that you can achieve at the time when you need to achieve it.
Yeah.
And therefore it's perhaps then looking at what injuries you suspect that they have, what neurology that they have already existing, and really actually the only careful group that we really need to be looking at is those that have no neurology but have significant neck pain.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they can't self-extricate, then doing something controlled, when they've not got other injuries that are time pressuring us.
Yeah, we've got the time to play with.
Then you can do the controlled extrication. But if they've already got neurology, yes, we don't want to, you know, have a second hit to their neurology.
Mm.
But we know that that's a time-critical injury, so we need to get them out quickly.
Mm.
And equally, if they've got no neurology but other significant injuries, we also want to get them out because they've got time-critical injuries.
Yeah.
So actually having to slow the whole thing down to take the roof off perhaps isn't necessary unless they've not got time critical injuries and they don't have neurology.
Yeah, significantly mechanically.
It's nice to see we've moved forward from a point where, I know many years ago, they've probably taken a lot more car roofs off unnecessarily, and it's nice that we've got some studies out there now. We can come to a place where we can confidently make appropriate decisions based off the type of incident we're faced with, isn't it?
I think that that was the genesis of why they've done that research, to try and inform that discussion. Because, you know, the other thing that they bring up in the demographics is these, you know, significant rate of head injury in these patients. Again, we'll have a factor of, look, you're looking at 1% of them having a spinal injury. Even if they're entrapped, okay, it's 50% higher, but that's still only 2% of entrapped patients are going to have a spinal injury.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're going to have a significant visceral injury, organ injuries, torso injuries, and the biggest factor, which is head injuries.
Mm, more detrimental to them.
Yeah, and them worrying about C-spine. Yeah.
Worrying about their C-spine, putting a collar on them and raising the cranial pressure, and all things that actually, you're treating a very small group of patients and potentially detrimental. Is that what you want?
Yeah, that was kind of exactly what I was after, just opening up that discussion, because I know you've got like a lot more expertise on that area than I have, a lot more background specifically in that area than I've got to bring to the party.
I mean, still, how do you
triage them? I was just going to say that it kind of, that's, I think the study quite nicely shows what we know from our real world practice now, isn't it? So if you have a patient that is willing to get out of a car and they're willing to extricate under their own steam, I have yet to find a patient in my career that I've been surprised later that they've managed to get themselves out of a car and yet they've got an unexpected neck injury. So it's you know, I think this paper really, you know, should empower paramedics to, you know, if the patient can get themselves out of a car and they are, you know, and they're in agreement to get out of the car, they should feel empowered to let the patient do that. under their own steam. And that might be stepping out and lying down and immobilising on a trolley once they've stepped out. But doing prolonging scene times and cutting out cars when the patient is actually, if you ask the question, they are willing to step out.
Yeah.
I think that's you know.
I think, like you say, it's just helped justify what we've all been kind of thinking and what we've all been heading towards intuitively, but it's just quantified it for us, hasn't it, and helped us make decisions off that.
What did that paper say? You have to forgive me because I haven't read it for a while.
No, it's all right.
But that paper, though, did say that the least movement was for self-extrication with a C-spine collar, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I've got it in front of me here.
So actually, which is probably moves away from what most of us have been practicing over the last 10 years, because actually, you know, C-spine collars were very much in favour, and they've very much fallen out of vogue, haven't they? And we carry C-spine collars for max fax splinting, and that's about it really these days.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, if you were to believe, you know, the movements of this, the least movement would be to put a C-spine collar and ask them to step out.
Do you think that's because it's a visual cue for the person, though? That, like, this is serious now, somebody's put this on, I can now feel this. You know what I mean? Do you think people take extra care of themselves when you've applied that?
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, possibly. If I'm being honest, I don't know. What do you think?
Because the numbers are still low, aren't they? Like less than 1%.
Because again, if I were to relook at the paper, I think it...
Is that why it's the more stable movement? Because if they're getting out themselves, there's nothing stopping them move. Yeah. That's stopping them move, but also they're...
But this is very variable, because this would have been done in a controlled manner with a correctly fitting C-spine collar. And what we know is that actually an incorrectly fitted C-spine collar, which is harder when the patient's actually in a car in the dark, you know, and it's raining, etc., etc., the chance of you fitting that C-spine collar correctly is much less than in experimental conditions, I would suspect.
Especially they did four groups. So it was the casualty can self-extricate or extricate with minimal assistance.
Yeah.
That was the first one. The second one was the casualty is unable to self-extricate due to their pain or physiological response due to the injuries, but can be assisted from the vehicle, so assisted extrication versus self-extrication. Third one was the casualty either is advised or chooses not to self-extricate due to concern of exacerbating injuries. So that one would be medically trapped. And then number four, the casualty is physically trapped in the vehicle, maybe due to displaced road furniture or sort of wreckage intruding the cab of the vehicle, but it's not a medical entrapment. They were the four kind of groups that they had. Again, just backing up what Amir said as well, so in the healthy volunteers, self-extrication, they said in this conclusion, is associated with the smallest spinal movement and the fastest time to complete extrication. Rapid B-post removal or roof-off extrication types were associated with similar movements, and time to extricate was expanded in the ones where we got to be mechanically ripping them out of the vehicle versus just getting them to step out. Like you said, it's interesting, is it? Is putting a collar on them to get them to extricate, is that like, oh, like you said, this is serious now, I better keep really still? Mm. Or is it actually innately doing something and keeping it still, and who knows?
Mm. Call it my cynicism.
But if anyone wants to go and look at that paper, it is open access and it is titled Assessing Spinal Movement During Four Extrication Methods, a biomechanical study using healthy volunteers. It's by Tim Nutbeam and Rob Fenwick et al. And it's published in the Scandinavian Journal of Trauma, Resuscitation and Emergency Medicine.
It probably might be worth just mentioning at that point as well, just from a human factors and a sort of scene management type point of view, I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that our fire and rescue service colleagues do an excellent job at the side of the road, and they do what they are trained to do, and that is to create as much space for us to get this casualty out. So they assume, effectively, if a patient is in a car, they assume that they are trapped and we're going to want their car cut up in order to get that patient out.
Yeah.
So I think it's, and you know, they are doing their job very well, and it's invariably whatever they've achieved by the time you rock up to scene is always helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's sometimes quite hard, isn't it, to once you've gone down a road of cutting, to kind of stop that process.
Yeah.
And it feels almost rude to our fire and rescue service colleagues, doesn't it, to say, well, actually, no, we're going to pause there.
Yeah,
and I'm actually going to ask the patient to step out.
Yeah.
But, you know, we just need to be respectful for professionals. They are doing what they're trained to do. And we come in, do your medical assessment. And, you know, if that patient can step out, that's great. Do your assessment and ask the patient to step out. and that's okay.
That's made all the more easier by explaining to the fire brigade what you're doing and talking to them beforehand, and this is why we're doing it, rather than just walking in between and going, stop cutting, and you know, John, can you get out of the car and walk over here, and walking away with the patient and never explaining to the fire service why you've done what you've done. So what you're saying is absolutely right. Like, they've done a great job up until that point, and then involved them in, you know, this is the information. Have I definitely got this right? Have we got anything to add from before we've arrived? No. But then if this is the information, then I'm pretty happy for them to make an attempt to step out of the car, then they'll understand
that. And there's like those key terms, isn't there? When I was looking at some notes in preparation for sitting down today, with key terms to use with the fire service colleagues. So, like, you know, you get to the scene and you've identified you need that patient out, you need them out now because they're really sick, or they are in some kind of traumatic arrest and you just need them out of the vehicle. So it's words like, we need this, we need an immediate rescue on this vehicle, we need immediate removal of the patient. So that's when they'll kind of quickly get them out, as, you know, as fast as possible with whatever means are available to them. Or are we going to go for a controlled release, which means you've got a bit more time to play with and you can be treating the patient in situ whilst they're working to get the patient out. So I suppose just identifying, do you want them out immediately because you are really, really concerned? Maybe they've got a cat hemorrhage, etc. Or have we got a little bit more time to play with? Can we do a controlled release as part of that?
Yeah.
I think I think that you make a really good point there, Tom, but it's always worth just remembering that no matter what type of patient we've got, we always want them out of the car as quickly as possible. We know that being in the car is detrimental to the patient, so we always want them out as quickly as possible. So there isn't a slow extrication plan here. There is a what time frames are we working to?
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, that I made the point earlier about having to switch tack and saying, well, we need this patient out right now, for example. And actually, if the fire service are already cutting, getting everyone in that shared mental model of your change and worry about this patient when you want to actually get them out straight away. Sometimes words don't actually do it. So you might say, I need this patient out right now, and you'll find people keep cutting and keep ignoring you.
They don't quite understand what you mean as a medical professional as right now.
So actually, quite often what I find the most helpful things, if you are that worried about the patient and you really need that patient out now, just getting your hands on as the clinician and starting to physically take that patient out yourself, you'll find that people will stop and give you a hand.
I was going to point this kind of question to you anyway. We've already kind of started to allude on it now, in terms of like medical interventions we need to consider in situ and then once extricated. So in situ, I've got some notes prepared on this that a trauma doctor called Andy Putney, I think he's a trauma doctor in Yorkshire, you guys probably know who he is, isn't
it? Poutney.
Sorry, Andy, if you're listening.
We knew you were.
So he did some bits on this about talking about in situ management, so things like airway management, initial oxygenation of the patient, immediate intervention that you're doing, like fluids or blood, to stabilise the patient in the initial phase, maybe analgesia to help the extrication phase or some sedation if required. So do you want to kind of just touch on what you guys as like enhanced care practitioners might be able to bring to the party in terms of that initial in situ management of the patient if they are trapped?
Do you want to start?
Yeah. So with any of these cases, but the critical things is doing the fundamentals well from the outset. So when you kind of gain initial access to these patients, starting that initial assessment, gaining some understanding of their anatomical injuries, what their physiological status is, because then you can start pigeonholing them into they're okay, they're not that well, and then they're big sick. And then also starting those initial interventions, those life-saving measures that we all know from the alphabet. But there's nothing, you know, there's no high-level interventions that are required from that initial outset.
Yeah, and that's probably something that, something right through from an ECA to technician to paramedic level can be done prior to you guys arriving as well. You're just having a good primary survey, like you said, and working out, is this patient big sick or little sick, just from the alphabet of A to E, do your ABCD assessment and work out in a situ, are they really poorly, are they not?
Most importantly, all of the complex, high skill interventions are meaningless actually if the patient hasn't had the basics done, and also that the patient treatment is necessary to be done immediately.
Yeah.
Because that's actually what they need right then.
And we were talking about this sort of off mic, weren't we, just a minute ago, about don't wait for enhanced care to come before you start cracking on with doing the basics, and doing the basics properly and doing them well is just crack on with that immediate management that needs doing. And it might not even be like you said, Gucci advanced care interventions, it might just be the very, very basics.
And I think then what echoes and what some of these, you know, principles that are talked about around, you know, interventions for entrapped patients or patients in situ in vehicles is actually slightly detracting from some of the, whilst we might think the patient might benefit from something being done, actually it's what the patient needs right there, right then, and tempering what might actually delay the extrication of the patient or raise the complexity of what is trying to be done in situ, rather than actually facilitating. And this is perhaps where there's a two-way process between the assessment and the treatment and the extrication and the extrication plan that's being implemented. Because actually having, if you can't assess the patient properly, then that puts them in a time, mostly into a time critical situation, because you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Equally, you can analgese this patient to mitigate for some of their, you know, relative entrapment because they're, you know, too much pain to get out, then you might change the extrication because of the intervention that you perform. So there's that interplay that has to happen. But in the enhanced care team, what they don't want to be doing is trying to do some complex intervention in a confined space that takes a long time.
And we've got to think about the safety aspect of it as well, haven't we? Like you said, making sure the vehicle's safe and secure for us to be doing that in the vehicle. It's not always going to be, you know, it's an ever-changing landscape, isn't it, of environment, these things.
It has to be very dynamic in that sense.
Steph, do you want to talk about sort of once extricated, once we've got that patient out and we've got them in a more appropriate environment, or beyond the ambulance, what we're going to be thinking about doing once we've got that patient out and they're ready to treat?
Sure. So I think this is where good working paramedic crew that have been with this patient since they were trapped in the car, you know, they are absolutely worth their weight in gold if they can think ahead of what's going to be happening next. Mm-hmm. So as Emma was saying, getting the basics done well is great. And if you have to wait for an enhanced care team, doing things like keeping the patient warm, getting some IV access, getting the TXA in, if they're still stuck in the vehicle and you can get that done, that's great.
You mentioned to me something the other day on the job, it's quite a while ago now actually, it said the other day it was coma. And you guys probably all know what that is, don't you? But I'd never heard of that, nor of my colleague. And we've used that since
on
bigger trauma jobs, and it does help just to kind of bring your mind into focus if you're a little bit scrambled. Would you mind just explaining that for the benefit of anyone who's listening? The coma principles, and I'll let you get on with what you were saying as well.
And where did it come from? How did you come up with it?
So coma is actually something that we use on the care team an awful lot, just to remind us of it's a way of allowing us to split down tasks within the team, especially on those complex jobs where actually, you know, your bandwidth is saturated because of the complexity of it. And effectively, quite often what we might do is give coma the responsibility of one sole clinician on the team, or one physician on the team, and that is effectively our very basic trauma skills that we need to do to properly assess and treat this patient. And that would stand for close off, so we cannot assess a trauma patient from head to toe unless they are what we would call nice trauma naked. Everyone loves that phrase. But realistically, if your patient is not trauma naked, you have not done a full assessment of your patient, and you cannot hand over to the hospital that you have done a full assessment, and you won't be aware of the extent of their injuries. And it's those patients that you haven't assessed fully that you always regret later on, because you hand them over, they've rolled them, you find that extra stab wound on their back or whatever that you didn't notice. So it's really important that you do, get the clothes off and do a thorough examination. Oxygen on, we know that, say for example, if you are waiting for a critical care team and they've got a big head injury, they've, you know, whatever, it may be that we want to undertake some big airway interventions, and getting that patient well oxygenated buys us an awful lot more time. So getting the patient well oxygenated before is good. Monitoring is really important. Now, for our paramedic colleagues out there, one thing that the critical care teams will do, which you'll find entirely frustrating probably, is that you will find that your monitor is on, and when we rock up to scene quite often, your monitor will come off and our monitoring will go on.
Yep.
And we may end up asking you to assist us with that.
Yep.
There are reasons behind that. It just allows us, sometimes our monitors do extra bits and pieces like mm-hmm. temperature monitoring and pacing and cardioversions, those sorts of things. So it's yep. really important that we do that process. We're not doing it just to be really annoying. And then access. No matter how poorly your patient is, things get a lot better when you've got some IV access mm-hmm. because the minute you've got IV access, I can get the patient off to sleep. We can give them blood products. We can give them all the medication we need to. We can give them all the analgesia requirements that we need to. So if you are able to get IV access, please do it.
Yeah.
If your patient is super sick and they're, minimally conscious, please get some IO access yeah. if you can't otherwise. So we usually hand off that kind of that mental framework to one person on the team to make sure those bits are done
yeah.
to allow other team members to focus on treatment priorities, etc.
Yeah, and that's stuff that can all be going on
concurrently
and hopefully before any enhanced care teams arrive, like if we can really push the message of getting people to do those basics and do the basics well before
yeah.
you guys arrive, then it sets the patient up for a better treatment plan, doesn't it, and a smoother handover of care.
I think some tips from me on coma as well, some additional stuff with the clothes off, that should be your prompt to warm the patient as well. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to remove layers, that should be your visual prompt that we need to warm this patient, because obviously hypothermia and trauma don't go well together, and not to panic and take it too literally in certain circumstances regards things like underwear. Thin underwear is mm-hmm. fine under a pelvic binder. The faculty pre-hospital care consensus statement recognizes that, so not to panic about taking trauma naked too literally, especially when dignity is at play as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think when it comes to monitoring as well, we're not used to, as clinicians on the roads working on ambulances, cycling our blood pressures to 2 or 3 minutes or 5 minutes. We're not used to that. And then we can get distracted on these particular jobs as well.
So it might be 10 minutes or 15 minutes.
Exactly.
So you haven't done one. Yeah.
When we come to monitoring, I think when the monitoring goes on, I think cycle your blood pressure, set it to automatic. And then if you're distracted, the blood pressure is still happening. And any time you remember to look, you've got an accurate blood pressure within the last 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah. Okay, great. I wanted to move on to talk a little bit about pelvic injuries and pelvic management in RTCs, unless you guys have got anything else you want to talk about or touch on stuff we've already kind of gone over, or anything else to add before?
We didn't actually talk about what we're going to do outside the car. Did you want to finish that?
Yes, yeah, let's finish that.
Between the car and the ambulance. Straight to the ambulance.
Yeah, let's do that. So,
but if it's not useful, we don't need to.
No, let's do it, because, yeah.
This was just another thought that crossed my mind, is that I guess we're framing a lot of this as if there is an enhanced care team coming.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily always the case, or
no.
It might not be the eventuality
mm-hmm.
or in the time frame that we'll see. Whilst we said, don't wait to do things, but also just don't wait.
Yeah.
If things need to be done, they need to be done. And so I think a lot of the messages that we'd be conveying as an enhanced care team, we're going to try and come and set up a kit dump, outside the vehicle for the post-release management. That's something that is equally applicable for any responder. To be doing, if you're part of the team that you're working for, isn't having immediate access to the patient, you can be setting up for their post-release management, how you're going to extricate this patient.
Just trying to be one step ahead of the game.
Yeah, yeah. And then also, thinking of Peter already touched about warming, but it's the ambulance setup to minimise the transit time from getting out to being ready to go.
Yeah, that's a good point. Cool. So let's move on to pelvic injuries and pelvic injury management in this cohort of patients, or RTC patients. We've already kind of touched on briefly that there's been studies out there, namely the one we talked about by Tim Nutbeam and Rob Fenwick et al., around the demographics and injury patterns and outcome data for patients who are trapped versus non-trapped. And we've already mentioned that they identified that trapped patients had more significant injury patterns. So really it's something we should be considering and watching out for, particularly in these higher mechanism RTCs. So Amir, would you like to talk a little bit about just kind of pelvic injuries and the anatomy around pelvic injuries and why it could be a problem if that patient has sustained a pelvic injury?
Yeah, of course. So the pelvis itself is made up as a ring, and pelvic fractures get differentiated into two types, principally around whether that ring has been broken or whether it's the socket of your hip joint that's broken. And those are acetabular fractures, and while they still get talked about as pelvic fractures, acetabular fracture is something slightly different injury pattern to that of the pelvic ring injury, and it's the pelvic ring injuries that are most concerning. It's for two sort of main reasons, really, that there can be significant blood loss from the fractures, the bone surfaces that have been damaged themselves, but also the large amount of pelvic vasculature that's housed by the pelvis. When those ligamentous and bony restraints are damaged, those soft tissue planes are sheared apart as the pelvis breaks. It disrupts that those blood vessels, but it also loses the ability to have any form of natural tamponade. It's essentially opening the box that allows the blood volume. So the true pelvis, it takes about 100 millilitres, whereas the false one, the entire pelvis can take about 2.5 litres.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in continuity with the abdominal cavity as well, the retroperitoneum. And so when they have major pelvic injuries, then their entire circulating volume can be lost into the pelvis and the retroperitoneum. So this is why pelvic fractures can be so significant, and why we're trying to look out for them so critically, but their physiology would respond alongside that. So there are a few elements that we can think about in our examination to try and identify whether they have injuries. Pelvic asymmetry on examination, feeling for their iliac ring heights, feeling at the front of the pelvis, the pubic symphysis, are there any large gaps or steps? Whilst we don't advocate springing the pelvis anymore, that's quite a slightly arcane thing, but feeling whether there's actually any instability when we palpate the pelvis, feeling around it, any crepitus, maybe bruising, hematomas that have started to form. These are all hallmark features of a patient having a pelvic injury. We want to balance this also, have they been mobile since the time of the injury? Can they straight leg raise, even if they're lying still on the ground? Can they lift their legs up? Again, it might be a sign that the pelvis is still intact. So it's factoring these all in, along with their physiology, to determine whether you think that they've got significant pelvic injury.
Okay. Will all ring fractures present a splayed pelvis?
No.
No. Splayed legs?
And again, this is, we can expand on that in terms of the mechanisms that are described for pelvic fractures. And they're kind of categorised into these sort of four main domains around the lateral compression injuries. There's the anterior posterior compression that typically results in that open book pelvis, and then the vertical shear, and you can try and bring some of the mechanism of their injury then into the pelvic fracture. And if we think about some of the occasions where, you know, a side impact RTC or somebody that's fallen in a sort of low height injury, they might have a lateral compression type.
And then the anterior posterior was like a motorbike, maybe.
Yes,
if you got going over the handlebars.
The motorcyclist, when their pelvis hits the tank, that splays them. It's also a pedestrian, often they're getting hit from behind, and again it opens their pelvis from the front as they get thrust forward and strips a lot of ligaments. Vertical shear ones often come from falls from height, and you often think heels and heads, so injuries to the calcaneums. An injury to their pelvis, and they often have a head injury as well. And it's a fairly well recognised pattern for those injuries. But actually, all of those can exist, or they can be mixed mechanisms for the pelvic fracture. So it's just trying to categorise the patient: is this a high energy or a low energy mechanism?
Yeah.
And that will then feed into the suspicion that you might have about having a pelvic fracture that you combine then with what examination findings you've got and what physiology they're in. Because again, if they've got no signs, but physiologically they're very compromised, then you might think, well, actually, might treat in case, because they've got a high energy mechanism, I'm trying to consider a pelvic injury.
Yeah.
Whereas actually if they're hemodynamically stable with no signs, even if they've got a mechanism, actually, what are you trying to manage with that?
Yeah.
Considering
we talked a little bit about that earlier, didn't we, about
over triaging
and maybe over treating people by putting them on if they don't need to be on.
Yeah, and hopefully some of the information from this podcast and some of the reference material we're talking about will empower clinicians to just have that lower threshold to maybe start ruling things out and looking at the bigger picture and the whole picture and a more holistic view of the scene, the mechanism, the patient presentation, their trend over the time they've been with them, to indicate that, you know, there's a low likelihood of these open book and pelvic ring fractures. I think the incidence from blunt trauma for pelvic fractures around 5 to 12%, and about 3 to 4% of those have open book pelvic fractures. So it's a fairly, you know, low frequency event. And hopefully clinicians listening to this will have a bit more of that information that will empower them to kind of hopefully, you know, not put that binder on and over triage just simply based on mechanism and the fear of mechanism.
It's like we said when we were talking about it off mic earlier, about if your patient is self-mobilised since and they hemodynamically are quite seemingly well, and there's, other than the mechanism, like Amir was saying, there's no kind of suspicion to believe that there is actually an innate pelvic fracture there, why are you putting that pelvic binder on? Are you doing it just because it's something you think you should do, or are you doing it because you're actually worried about that patient had a pelvic injury?
And like what Amir has explained about, you know, the you'll get physiological changes and you'll get major blood loss with these patients, so you'll see that. So if you have a patient that's taking a certain amount of time to be extricated from a car because they're mechanically trapped for one reason or another, you've got to ask yourself, do I really need to put them in a pelvic binder if I'm waiting half an hour for them to come out and all their physiological parameters are within normal ranges, and you've asked to stand out of the car, and then, you know, when they become freed, and then lie down on a pelvic binder, and you know what I mean?
I think that's probably trying to differentiate and trying to get it very clear in everybody's head that the pelvic binder is not a packaging item. This isn't a way we package our patients to take them off to hospital. This is a hemorrhage control device. So that's what we're putting it on for. So you need to be putting it on for a reason. So you're looking at an unwell patient with a suspicious mechanism that you are worried about. So it is something that you're putting on in a hurry because you are, you know, as Emma alluded to earlier, you know, the, you know, 1 litre for a true pelvis, 2.5 for the entire pelvis, you know, these are big volume blood loss. So that you will be looking at an unwell patient if they are having significant blood loss from a pelvic fracture. So pelvic binder isn't something that you're thinking about slow time. It's something that you are thinking about in your unwell patient and getting it on.
You're thinking about it in the C, as part of your CABC, your cat hemorrhage. You're walking up to a patient, somebody has come off a motorbike versus wall, and they've got a, you know, splayed legs, it looks like an obvious open book pelvis. You're going to be putting on that binder very early in that scenario, not when you're coming to the packaging phase.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean?
Real.
You said 100 mils, you meant 1,000 mils.
Yes, sorry.
When you're on about the ring.
You said the true pelvis volume be 100 mils, you meant 1,000.
Even worse.
Yeah. a litre and 2.5 litres, that's what you meant if you read it.
There was some data, it's quite old data now, to be fair, it's 2007. They looked at how serious are pelvic injuries, so they did they examined some data from the TARN database. This was, I'm going to have a go at trying to pronounce his name. Giannoudis, that's it. So they did a study in 2007, and they found that in the UK, 8% of the TARN cases at the time that have a pelvic fracture, so 8% of the cases they took have some kind of pelvic pathology. And they also found as part of that study that those people that did have pelvic fractures, there was a 14.2% chance of mortality in those. In the non-pelvic category, there's a 5.6% mortality bracket. So it's just reinforcing that it can be a huge injury to sustain, can't it? And it can have some quite dire consequences for these patients. Is there anything, maybe Steph, you want to just quickly run us through things that we can be looking for, like the Hateful Eight and things like that, because that's something that is thrown around quite a lot these days, and maybe just good to kind of go over it again.
Alright, I was going to say, we can sort of draw that in, because again, that's when we're looking at these, the physiological response that these major blood loss patients will have, and it's trying to hang your hat on certain parameters that we're looking at, and I'm going to use that as a lead-in so that Steph can explain what's meant by that Hateful Eight.
Well, I don't think it should be all I mean to explain all of the Hateful Eight. I think we should all very much join in.
We'll have a 20-minute break.
Yeah. As we said, this would be an unwell-looking patient. And quite often, I think more recently, the Hateful Eight is definitely something that's becoming more common in our terminology and more common in our language, which is great to see. And it effectively just describes a constellation of symptoms that you might expect from our significantly bleeding patients. And I think one of the first ones that I actually quite like to talk about really is that air hunger. You know, that starts off with just that raised respiratory rate sometimes, doesn't it? That I think that's a really sensitive sign in that our really unwell patients. So if you've got a tachypneic patient...
Are they launching like a respiratory alkalosis to compensate for
absolutely.
A metabolic acidosis?
And I think it's just a really sensitive marker of just an unwell patient. So yes, we have to take into other factors like pain and anxiety and all those other bits and pieces. But I think if you've got a tachypneic patient, you're probably looking at an unwell patient. And the extreme end of that spectrum is then your air hunger. So that is your, you know, they've lost a lot of blood and they are working very hard to keep them well perfused, keep their tissues well perfused. That'd probably be the first bit that I would like to talk about.
So the other one that I find really useful at the outset is the level of agitation that the patient's demonstrating. Again, the brain is a very sensitive organ to hypoxia, and so if they're not celebrating, if they're not thinking, you know, clearly. Whilst this also can be masked by a lot of other things, intoxication being one of the principal ones, also the big lights, loud sirens,
intoxication, drugs, or head injuries, there's all sorts, isn't there?
But actually being sort of acutely aware that this person is not behaving like somebody that's well, that's another kind of hallmark to try and put you into the right mindset to say this patient potentially could be really unwell.
Yeah, and I think there can be, you know, signs that they're not peripherally perfusing themselves as well. So you'll get pallor, or the patient will be pale, and they'll be shut down peripherally, and that'll make it hard for you to gain IV access. So that should be a kind of an obvious cue in the scenario that if you're having difficulty gaining IV access peripherally, and they've probably got some collapsed veins, it's probably difficult to gain access. So I think those are two that go hand in hand there, collapsed veins and pallor and stuff, because they're peripherally kind of shut down, shunting blood back to their vital organs due to hypotension.
And it's that actually can be quite difficult sometimes to get your head around, can't it? Because you've got that cold patient who's lying on a concrete floor who's, you know, just compensating for the fact that they're cold. I think it's a really good thing to keep in mind, because if you've got a trauma patient with a systolic blood pressure of 60, 70, but they've got whopping great big veins that you can eat, you know, you'll find yourself at the side of the road popping in a grey cannula with no problem. Either A, you're seeing the patient really at their very acute, like, phase of their illness.
Is that like a neurogenic shock
Maybe what we need to be thinking about is actually maybe this isn't the pelvis, maybe this isn't the bleeding, and we actually need to think about something else.
Some spinal cord pathology.
Yeah, bleeding mimic, and that's a podcast for another day.
Yeah, that's a podcast. That's a podcast in itself, isn't it? And then we've just got, I think you've touched on hypotension, the tachycardia and bradycardia, or bradycardia, I suppose, as part of that. Are they trying to compensate, or have they, like you said, reached that phase where they've gone through the compensatory mechanisms and now they've gone bradycardic as a result of low flow? And the last one is low or a falling end tidal, if we've got end tidal monitoring available to us.
And again, I think it circles a little bit back to the monitoring statement that was made, that the trends are really important, and some of those one-off values are not necessarily that useful, but having been able to spot a trend over a period of time is much more valuable to that. And again, it reiterates that, you know, try and get them on the cycle, making sure that it's been applied and kept on as best you can.
Wicked. Do you want to kick start us off, Amir, with application
stuff? Yeah, so to bring a slightly different concept to it, that it around, rather than applying a pelvic binder, we're looking at about binding a pelvis, and that process of how we do that. It comes beyond just putting that binder around their hips. If we recognise that a patient's got legs that are splayed apart or that their limbs aren't in an anatomical position, we want to bring their legs together, pull them to length as best we can to position them. This principally helps that it'll give us our anatomical landmarks for putting the binder on, trying to find their greater trochanters. But also if we think about how those legs are splayed, it actually starts to act as closing the pelvis by bringing the legs, bringing the feet together. It also helps that if you imagine putting a binder on with their legs splayed, then any movement or any packaging of that patient, no matter how tightly we put the binder on with their legs apart, the way that our hips and our buttocks will lie once our legs are together, then the binder itself will probably be a bit loose and slide around there. And that probably corresponds with some of the reasons why the binders end up not in the right place, even though they were put on the right place.
They've come loose, yeah.
So, being able to bring their feet together and to hold them together as well so that they don't move around so much. Steph brought in a really good human factors point about triggering that.
Yeah, so I think it's like you said, you can get stuck in your thought process, can't you? Of, you know, you're doing your HOT principles or whatever. I've put a pelvic binder on, that's great, you know, that's sorted. But actually, you know, the next stage is always get those feet together to close that volume, as Emma's described. I've always found that really quite tricky to make sure that I remember to do that. And actually, one of the services that I fly with at the moment is great, just these simple things that work much better. We actually sticky tape a triangular bandage to our pelvic binders, so every pelvic binder has got a triangular bandage attached to it. And you know, much more frequent on that service, you'll find that our patients go in with the pelvic binder in place and their feet bound together. And I think that that's really helpful in making sure that you've done that whole process rather than just the pelvic binder application.
I think another important point as well for people just to make note of is don't log roll the patient if we're putting a pelvic binder on. So obviously we're trying to minimise the movement whilst getting the binder on. I think that's more of just like a human factors thing of like losing focal point of what it is you're trying to achieve. You're putting a pelvic binder on to bind the pelvis, as you said in your own words, not just putting it on either for the sake of it or getting a bit lost in thought as to the actual basic anatomy of what you're trying to do. So it's just keeping them at a low angle whilst you're trying to get it on,
or 15 degree tilt.
Yeah, no more than a 15 degree tilt. Yeah,
it's if we go back to like the Faculty of Preoperative Cares, you know, their consensus statement is all about minimal patient movement, isn't it? So if you know, it's not a packaging item, so you have to get that pelvic binder on as soon as you can. But if you can coordinate that one 15 degree tilt that you're going to do with the application of the pelvic binder and the scoop,
we are recording this on an ambulance station, by the way, so. That's why you've got that.
It's not just petering time.
Yeah. So that's really important, because then if you can just do it in a runner, then that's less movement for the patient, less chance of clot rupture.
Did you get the bit about the knees up? Did you?
No.
I think, yeah, we'll come back to that. We're talking about it off mic, weren't we? The inside scoop. Pardon the pun.
Yeah, so some more recent literature has come to light in terms of looking at intrapelvic pressures, and what the binder is trying to do is to recreate the tamponade effect to try and stop some of the bleeding occurring. And trying to raise that pressure, the binder does that, but actually by bringing the feet together, by actually raising the knees so there's a small bend in the knees, or a 30 degree bend, the pillow or blanket underneath their knees also replicates generating increased intrapelvic pressure. Combining that with a binder then gets the maximal intrapelvic pressure that we can generate for tamponading of bleeding. So unless the patient's needing to have a KTD on for a femoral shaft fracture, we should ideally try and package the position of the patient so that they have feet together, knees with a gentle bend, and the knees bound together as well, and then the binder on at a trochanteric level, and then the compression of the binder to the
You say it's about a 30-degree tilt for the knees.
Yeah, so just the knees bent up. So again, having a spare pillow or a rolled-up blanket underneath probably is enough as a sort of memory prompt about how much just to pop something under the knees. It also is often a nice, neat position to start sliding the binder under from. You can either get it in from the hollow of the back if there's a space when they're on the scoop. Mm. Actually, if they're not, if they're just on the ground, bring their knees up gently. You can, that's sort of entry point that you can slide the binder in if you're either going to seesaw it or if you're just gently going to lift that patient as opposed to doing a small roll.
Mm.
Again, particularly if you're doing this as an individual because it's a critical intervention, you might not be able to coordinate enough hands to roll that patient. But actually, if you're doing it by yourself, again, just slide, gently lifting a patient or gently rolling a patient using the binder. To gently seesaw that underneath.
Is there any particular landmark or location that's going to be the most ideal to, if you are gently lifting them, to seesaw that underneath? Is it, should we be aiming for a certain position for that, arms or hands to, like, are we aiming for the great edge canter? Are we aiming for the just above? Do you know what I mean? Where,
so again, if you think the binder is going to be applying compression at the trochanteric level, so that's the kind of the safe position to again gently apply the pressure enough to lift their buttocks.
Just a very small amount to slide it, yeah.
Hopefully we're not really moving the patient themselves. We're just trying to lift the bit that's in contact with the ground enough to get the few millimetres of the binder underneath them to that trochanteric level, which again is often a bit lower than what is perceived when you feel for the hips of the patient.
Yeah.
And that again is the most common reason the binder being in the incorrect position, that it's too high. Yeah, and again, it's trying to use those the landmarks that well, they might have. They might not have them as well, particularly if they've got a lot of bruising across their belly. It's be difficult, or if there's this skeleton is displaced, it can be quite difficult to identify those landmarks. So it's trying to put them in combination. Yeah, so yeah, the level of the pubis, you know, just above the base of the penis, trying to feel for the hips, trying to feel the where the quadriceps muscle starts to weigh. Can we feel their femoral artery pulsation if they still have one? Again, if you can feel that, ideally the pelvic bone should just be below where you can feel the femoral artery pulse as well. Anything above that, if you start to cover their belly button, covering their pubis, to feel for their femorals, the binder's probably too high.
Quite useful that you're saying, just to provide that little 30 degree of flexion in the femurs, because actually most of our trauma patients would be much more comfortable actually in that position as well. So it's not natural for most of us to lie completely flat, it's quite uncomfortable.
Mm.
And by the time you add in other pathologies like intra-abdominal bleeding, all that sort of stuff, and you're slightly peritonitic, actually lying in that completely flat position is really
especially
sore
on a
for
scoop
most patients
as well.
So actually, you know, being able to kind of just provide that little bit of flexion takes the pressure off the abdominal wall, you know, much more comfortable for the patient.
And that was just a tiny other point that I, you know, suggest around, whilst we're talking about, you know, critically unwell patients, you know, hemorrhage control, this, the pelvic, the binding the pelvis being a hemorrhage control measure, which it principally is, if in a slightly probably rarer situation where the patient's got a pelvic injury but they're not hemodynamically compromised, you can think about binding the pelvis as an analgesic tool because you're trying to splint that fracture the same way that we put a KTD on a femoral shaft fracture.
Mm.
Don't want the bone ends just moving rolling around.
That intrafragmentary movement.
You do have a patient who you can, you know, converse with and identify that they've got focal pelvic pain, that they've got some features, asymmetry, bruising pattern. Again, you can trial putting the binder on to see if that makes them more comfortable. It might improve their, you know, analgesia requirement, and it might make them more comfortable for transfer, and that slightly comes into packaging. But when we're really talking about pelvic binding, it's because it's a hemorrhage control measure.
And that concludes the end of this episode. Thank you so much for listening to the show, and thank you to the care team for coming down to take part in this episode. As always, if you want to follow the show on Twitter, you can follow us on Twitter handle @medicmiddle to keep up to date with the latest and the latest updates on future episodes. Thank you again for listening, and we shall see you next time.